Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
You're listening to The Tillage Podcast with the Irish Farmers Journal.
Hello everyone, it's Thursday the 5th of May 2022. I'm Stephen Robb and you're all very welcome along to a special edition of the Tillage Podcast. So you might be asking why this week of all weeks is special. Well, after 38 weeks of recording the Tillage Podcast, this is the first time that my co-hosts Andy Doyle and Siobhan Walsh are actually sitting across from each other in the studio in the Irish Farm Centre as we speak. So say hello guys.
Hello.
Hi, Stephen. Hi, Andy. Hi, listeners.
Good to all be in the same room for a change in our high-tech studio here in the Farm Centre. Guys, I think before we get into this week's podcast, because we're all here in person, it's probably no harm to let our listeners know how much COVID has changed how we produce the Irish Farmers Journal. And maybe to put some context on it, Andy, you might just briefly explain to listeners the process of producing the paper week by week, you know, where we're all based, when was the paper sent out and just how it was done. And then we can talk about what happened during COVID.
Certainly, Stephen. I suppose if you go back 30 years ago, it was a very different technological environment to where it is now. But we're going to start a lot closer than that. So basically, we'd be talking about something pre-COVID. And I mean, pre-COVID, my standard week, I would probably be in the office for 4 of the 5 days on average for the year. We write articles, depending on whether it's going to be news or features or whatever it is. We'd normally write them in Microsoft Word, transfer them into a separate editing system for the other people in the Farmers Journal. So they would then take the information and pictures or whatever else we would send them and place it on the page. Then we would get a physical hard copy of the page to read it again and find any errors that we had in it or things that we might like expressed slightly differently and give it feedback physically to the people who were in the office beside us. So that in a sense is a standard process in terms of what we were doing. The pages then would move electronically across to the printers who were in the Irish Times printing facility just off the N7. Close to Dublin. So that's in a sense the process that I would have had or any of my colleagues would have had prior to COVID.
And paper printed, finished and en route by roughly what time of a Wednesday?
That all moved a little bit in recent years, but generally speaking, we would be aiming to be gone out of here by about 4 o'clock.
4 o'clock.
We would hope that everything would be gone by 4 o'clock.
Okay, and us, obviously we were all in the office at the time, so the majority of the writing by the editorial team was done in the office, wasn't it?
Yes, the majority. There were some people at that stage who would have worked more from home because they were living down the country and it suited them, and it actually suited the paper that they would be active in the local communities down the country. But the bulk of us were in the office, and generally speaking, we had a fluctuating stocking density in here, probably at its highest on Tuesday or on Wednesday morning, depending on what section we're talking about. Obviously, it was very big for news on Wednesday morning because it's kind of a bit like sowing a crop. If you don't either plough it or cultivate it or prepare it in some way, you can't actually drill it. So some pages have to be done before others, and we all have different deadlines for different elements of the paper on different days. And that is to facilitate the makeup of the pages and the preparation of the printing press also. So All of those things are important in terms of having a product that's workable and usable.
Yeah, okay. So then along comes COVID, and Siobhan, I'm going to bring you in a second here. Explain, in the first weeks of the pandemic, just how chaotic and uncertain the paper production process was?
Well, probably the biggest part of the uncertainty was whether or not the people outside of the Farmers' Journal family, how they were going to be able to cope. Would the printing press run? Would the delivery system to take physical papers from the printers to all of the news agents in the country, would they run? Would there be people available to drive the trucks, to man the printing press, etc.? That was a huge uncertainty. And I know that in the early weeks, we lived with deadlines that were brought considerably earlier so as to give us flexibility. In some instances, even a day earlier, to keep flexibility in the system so that we would be doing our damnedest at any stage to make sure the printer got to your local shop or distribution unit. So that was a really big uncertainty for a while. There was also, of course, the uncertainty as to whether or not the journal itself could cope technologically with having everybody working from home, using internet facilities that were maybe unproven and untested, and whether or not we did have the IT capacity to keep everybody working all of the time, considering that we still had IT people in the office, but we didn't have IT people at home. Mm-hmm. And behind all of that, then, there was this security and this potential for, be it organized crime or otherwise, to get into your system and absolutely disrupt everything you were doing. That kind of lived in the background there all of the time, because we had some experiences of that in the past.
Yeah, because you alluded to it there, but of course we have a large sub-ed team who physically take what we write and the pictures that we send in, you know, and they put it on the page and they make it look nice, you know, and the majority of that would have taken place in-house before COVID, and we had to figure out quickly how to outsource that to everybody's home.
Yes, and because they're dealing with much bigger files than we would be dealing with as journalists in terms of Microsoft Word or even moving pictures, they were using very big files, and technology had to be fine-tuned to enable the systems that everybody had in their homes to be able to cope with that transfer of data up and down the line. Yeah. So it was a big deal. It was an element of uncertainty. It's probably fair to say we didn't start completely from scratch, in that individuals had been doing some of this. And in many ways, we were just so fortunate that we had been outsourcing a little, because in theory, all we had to do was upscale the capacity in the system to cope with that. You always live in an area of uncertainty. If you upscale, it doesn't mean it works. Some other weak spot could appear. But a weak spot didn't appear, and well done to the management team and to the IT people for developing it and getting it working and keeping a paper on the streets for every week of COVID and beyond.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we had the advantage of, I suppose, being in here and knowing the process and knowing how it worked. But then, Siobhan, yourself, whenever you joined us, we were still working remotely. We were still remote at that stage, weren't we? So you're really thrown into the deep end.
Yeah, so I started in December 2020. So, and COVID, I suppose, I think we went into lockdown. We were still quite restricted at that time and went into lockdown again in the February. So, like, I think the three of us didn't meet until the open day in Oak Park last year. So it was right from December to June. But, like,
we were talking.
Physically, yeah, or maybe two of us met at a time or whatever. But, yeah, I suppose, like, the technology was amazing, and you know, Zoom and Teams, I suppose we felt like we met each other all the time.
We would be talking on a daily basis online.
Yeah, yeah. And like people, I suppose you never met like those people in sub-ed, you know, the facilities there that we had to meet, you felt like you were meeting people even though you were meeting them on a screen maybe. But I suppose we're extremely lucky and privileged to be in a sector where we're able to go outside and still meet our you know, meet our listeners and our readers and the farmers who are out there. And so in a lot of ways, like, the job didn't change. You know, you were still going out to farms, still going out to open days and variety trials or whatever it was. So, you know, it's great to be in a sector that still kept going.
But the difference was that we were all writing from home and sending it across digitally as such, and getting the pages back digitally and doing the corrections digitally and sending the page off for printing digitally.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose I worked in the journal on my work experience like years and years ago. So as Andy said, it's some change from seeing a page printed to correct, you know, we were correcting our pages at that time. And, you know, just getting it's an amazing achievement to get the paper done while everybody is working remotely like that.
So then just bring us to modern day, both of you now. Just give everyone a sense. We're all in the office today. Have the majority of the editorial staff returned to the office, or are we still remotely, or are we hybrid? And is that the way it's likely to be now going forward?
Well, perhaps, Stephen, I might say, kind of for definite for me, this is the first week that I've physically come to work since March 2020 to actually work. I've been in the office for different reasons, to meet people or to collect post or whatever. But this week was the first week I've come back to work. And I really worried about coming back to work in the same way as I worried about working from home, because to me, work is partly about the social element of it, meeting other people, either yourself or Siobhan or all my other colleagues, or indeed colleagues that are in the commercial side, in the sub-ed side, in the account side, you know, people that I've known for years. And part of coming to work was just the casual meeting of them, be it over the cup of coffee that you're organising for yourself or whatever. So now that we're back, you kind of have to wonder, well, is the restaurant open again as it used to be? How does the coffee machine work again? And all of these things you have to kind of learn from scratch. But, you know, you pick them up. And I must say, having come in on Tuesday, which was my actual first day back, it left me wanting to come back again. And that was something I wasn't exactly sure how I would feel.
Okay, look, I hope that's given everyone a flavour and an insight into how it all works here in the Farmers Journal, in the Irish Farm Centre in Dublin here. But look, guys, we have a podcast today and we have some craps to talk about. So let's get into it properly now. So look, I guess the conversation last week would have revolved around lack of rain and whether or not crops were in need of it and becoming under pressure. Well, look, I think a lot has changed in the space of a week and virtually everywhere has got rain at this stage. What are you seeing on the ground? Have crops physically responded to it for the better? Is it breeding any more problems now as a result? Just what are you seeing on the ground?
I think, yeah, crops definitely responded to it. And while some people were slagging us off last week for looking for rain, it was badly needed. And in the last few days, we've seen crops and, you know, barley or grass or whatever it is are all jumping out of the ground. And I suppose, but they had improved in between times. Probably when we did the podcast last Thursday, crops had been starting to look a bit better. Ground was warmed up and they were, you know, visibly starting to green up and tiller out. So, like, I suppose it's allowed for work to progress as well. So where we were waiting for weeds to come up on spring barley, those weeds are now up and were nearly up immediately once the rain came, and that's allowed people to get on with work. Winter barley crops are also, after jumping out of it this week, crops that were, you know, we were probably saying were very short all year, jumped out of it in the past week, probably getting a surge of nitrogen there from the rain as well. I think the rain has, it's visible, you can nearly see the crops changing on an hourly basis, not to mind a daily basis.
I think I was out around the country on Sunday, just purely by chance. And I would say that by Sunday, after Saturday's rain, you could see the crops just almost smiling at you. And that's a fairly good news, you know.
Yeah.
They were just visibly happier. The leaves were broader. They were standing out there. They weren't short of water. They weren't worried about should they be limp or not. And there weren't that many areas that would have had those big issues. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. We hadn't gotten to the stage of seeing the points of hills drying out. But whenever you see the points of hills drying out, you know, at that stage, you're probably suffering trace element deficiencies in the field that you may or may not even be seeing. And therefore, you know, this rainfall, it'll do good and bad, of course, because we're all very conscious of what wet weather diseases do for us and how big of a challenge they are. But keeping away the problems of trace element deficiency is a bigger overall benefit in terms of holding on to the yield potential that crops are generating in these few important weeks. So on balance, I think the rain will be good, even though we'll probably see some bit of a surge in Septoria, but we were going to see it anyway.
Yeah.
You know, it was always going to come. The dew at night is enough to drive on Septoria, but it will move faster and more vigorously with rainfall.
Yeah. Guys, I was out in the fields in Donegal last week, and you can read about it in this week's Tillage pages. Looking about and seeing what was going on, and in the spring barley crops, I'll be honest, I never found a single aphid. So I didn't. I saw plenty of BYDV, a scary amount of BYDV in winter barley crops, and just the myth of BYDV not being a thing in Donegal or aphid pressure being lower, completely blown out of the water this year. But in terms of what I saw in the fields, I didn't see many aphids. But I was out again then earlier on this week, and the buggers were there. And indeed, I saw photographs sent in from colleagues up in the northwest of high infestation rates of aphids. What are you seeing around the country, or what are you hearing around the country in terms of aphid pressure?
Stephen, I'll make a quick comment on that. I think a lot of people would make the comment that 2 or 3 weeks ago, aphids were much easier to find than they were over the last 2 weeks. And, you know, if you're looking for aphids in a winter corn scenario, start with the patch of BYDV. That's where you will tend to find them most readily. And, you know, they were visible, they were there. And then over the last couple of weeks, probably helped by the cold and particularly the harsh wind, and that always depends a little bit on where you are, the numbers almost fell away again. A few weeks ago, there was very visible quantities of ladybirds out there.
Yeah.
In the last 2 weeks, you don't see them anymore.
Now, they're probably not
gone. You know, if they're there, you know they're feeding on their favourite food, which is aphids. And if you can't see them, I won't say it's your problem, but it's a fact of life that they're there. But they waned. Again, I think the easterly wind will have driven the aphids underground and probably the ladybirds onto the ground, and therefore we don't see them.
Mm.
But once we pick up in temperature, then obviously we're going to get very significant multiplication of aphids, and therefore it'll become much easier to see them. And of course, the worry is that we now see more and more patches of BYDV in the winter crops, and we're all worried about the instant transfer of that BYDV. The aphids themselves are not the problem, but the transfer of BYDV from the winter crops into the spring crops. A lot of them are up, a lot of the spring crops are up, doing well, covering the ground quite quickly. And that's almost, well, it's a part insurance against infection. It's not an absolute insurance. But the later sown crops where you get leaves still with standing up, or maybe 70% of the ground still brown as you look from the top down. If there's an aphid flying in the air, that's almost like a magnet to them. They always want to come down. There must be some combination of green and brown that makes it look yellow in an aphid's eyes, and all insects are attracted to yellow. And that, I'm guessing, is somehow there in the background as to why they descend on these crops later in the season. Because they'll bypass the good crops and land in the later ones. The later ones could still be good crops, but just because they're open, they're more prone to aphids landing and virus transfer.
So that's a legitimate concern. So more so, if you have a winter barley crop with patches of BYDV in it, beside a relatively freshly established, freshly emerged crop of spring barley, spray.
Particularly if it's your crop, and if it's on the windward side, if the wind is coming over your winter barley into your spring barley, yes is the answer. I think the bigger question, and I'll have to say, I don't know if I or anybody else knows the answer to it, but when you see these aphids multiplying in your winter barley, the question is, you know, should you now be spraying the winter barley to get a further knockdown? Possibly having sprayed it once or maybe twice before, because you will still get transmission internally in the barley crop. The overall effects or consequences won't be as big or as bad, but you're still looking at a level of virus transmission within the crop, and that probably matters more for winter wheat or winter oats that have longer to go even than winter barley. Mm-hmm. But we don't have advice on that. The inclination would be, if at all possible, don't spray, because we're trying to protect aphids and we're trying to protect the environment. But we just don't really know what the right thing to do is. Is the way to prevent the problem of infection on the spring crops to spray all the winter crops again? I don't think so. I think that there'll still be sources of infection that will come from within nature, from grass wards, from hedge sides and all the rest. And, you know, the grass is there. I think virus will come from somewhere. So I think in the main, still, we'll be protecting the spring crops.
It's probably a good year on winter barley to look at what's there. And it's there's a lot of typical infection, like you see along by the ditches and the fences, that there's a line of yellow. And, you know, maybe people should just look back and maybe take a few notes and see when they sprayed, see where the infection is, what variety it's in, you know, and see is there anything that they could have changed that might impact on it.
That's an interesting comment, Siobhan, because I only spoke to somebody during the week and they commented about spraying their different crops at different times, which were all sown relatively close together. They got very different responses from the insecticides.
Yeah.
Possibly as much because the first one was too early,
yeah,
as because the second one was too late or optimum timed. You know, if you're spraying too early, they're not going to be there, and you're not going to get the kill, and you're not going to get enough persistence at the other end of the spray. And that's the challenge, and that's a comment that applies regardless of what the sowing date is.
Okay. Siobhan, on Footprint Farmers this week, you've done a great piece of work analysing leaf samples. Just explain to us what you did it, why you did it, and what you just found out.
Yeah, so we were doing plant counts, and at the same time we were doing the plant counts on spring barley. It was on Padraig Connery and Andrew Mulhare's farms. At the same time, we took samples of the plants. So we took about 40 plants in a field. You know, depending on the size, you might need more or less. And we took them as if you'd take a soil sample. So making sure that we had a representative sample.
This is spring barley, wouldn't it?
Yeah, sample in the field. So... And the main reason we were doing this is to test for nutrient deficiencies. And Andy was talking about nutrient deficiencies earlier on and, you know, had they become visible after the, you know, if we've no rain or whatever. So I suppose the main thing with a nutrient deficiency is to get it early. And loads of people will know what deficiency they have in their field. You know, maybe they're used to having a magnesium deficiency and they know what fields or what soil type they have. But it's a good idea, I suppose, to test crops. At times, you know, even if you know the deficiency, there could be another deficiency at play as well. But to test them before the deficiency is visible is the main thing, because once the deficiency is visible, it's done a lot of harm already. So what we did was took the sample before the herbicide was due, and the sample, so we took those 40 plants or whatever it was, clipped the roots off them, put them in a plastic bag. We delivered them to the lab straight away, but you could post them to the lab. Most labs will do it. So anyone who does your soil samples, cost is about €70 per sample. It is slightly dear, but maybe worth doing one year or two years.
€70 per sample. Is it one plant per sample, or is it
no? So that's the 40 plants together. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, and they test for loads of different nutrients. You can you test for your nitrogen, you can see if your nitrogen was used efficiently. So I think it's over, if you're over 4% or whatever, you're doing well on your nitrogen uptake. But what we found, look, the reports come back differently from all the labs, but they generally tell you where you are, and then they tell you if you're low, medium or high in a nutrient. All of the samples that we tested, so we had 17 samples, all of them were deficient in magnesium.
Really?
and fairly well deficient in magnesium. And then most of the samples were also deficient in manganese, not as severe as the magnesium. And then copper and zinc were the other two that they were deficient in as well.
And was the farmer expecting that based off where the crop was grown in the field or the field in general?
Yeah, they were expecting it for some of them, but not all the fields. So it was well worth the exercise. You know, and some land they mightn't have every year or whatever as well. And if you've a manganese or a magnesium deficiency and you're on rented land and you don't know that deficiency is there and you don't pick it up on time, it can have a severe effect on your yield. I should just say, when we're sampling, like if you have a problem area in the field, sample that separately. So, you know, so take a sample for the field that represents the field. But if you have a problem area sample, that's a second sample altogether.
So then that farmer can now target trace elements and nutrients towards those fields off the back of this result.
Yeah, and look, for now it's a foliar application, but maybe next year it's a seed dressing or it's in a fertilizer. But ultimately you need to start fixing your soils as well through organic matter or cover crops or whatever, improving your soil structure.
One thing that I would just like to add to that, and we talked about the need to try and identify problems before they become visible so as to prevent the loss of yield. But I think we have to be a small bit careful not to do it too early, because my kind of experience over time has told me that the first two leaves of the plant, which is, you know, there's a week's growth plus gone into this now, that the first two leaves will largely be fed by the reserves of the seed. So if you were getting plants and the very young plants, you may only be picking up whatever you pick up could be a result of what was in the seed or the source of the seed originally, rather than what's happening in the field in the year. So I think on the strength of it, you really would want to be pushing into the third or fourth leaf before you would begin to take samples and hope that there wouldn't be a problem visible before then.
Yeah. Sean, what was the turnaround time on those samples?
5 days.
5 days?
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a fine balance, you know, to get it in for, like, you don't want to be going out a second time with the sprayer. So, you know, try and get it done before the herbicide spray.
Okay, excellent. Nope. People can read all about that and much more on page 40 of this week's Farmers Journal newspaper. So, look, we're going to move on to a weekly section. That's grain markets, normally further back in the podcast, but any week there's big news, we bring it forward, and yet again, Andy, there is more news, even as early as this morning in grain markets. Explain to us what's going on.
Well, Stephen, I probably have difficulty with the second part of the question, as in explaining what's going on. I can tell you what's going on more easily. You know, on page 3 this week, I mentioned that the markets closed on Tuesday at 267 odd, 267.25, if I remember correctly. But markets livened up yesterday Wednesday, and for whatever peculiar reason, they're also very lively today. So markets are basically up 20 euro since close of business on Tuesday night. So the consequence of that is that the Glanbia price that I reported in the journal of 317 for green feed barley, 327 for green feed wheat for harvest. Today, private merchants were offering 330 for green barley. You know, that's a price that people can lock into. Again, the usual dilemma is there. Will it be higher tomorrow? None of us know that.
Yeah.
But, you know, not locking into a price of that magnitude and running the risk that prices could fall again. And I see every reason why they could stay, why there's a risk to prices. There's not a risk of prices collapsing, but there's always a risk of prices falling because the market doesn't particularly want to be paying that much if it has a choice. The same kind of acceleration in price levels is happening in the nearby and in the future prices, be that December, the following December as well. Mm. They're kind of all gone up around that 7 euro today.
So that was just to confirm, that's 330 green barley.
That was 330 for green feed barley for harvest, yeah.
That is serious.
I suppose it sits beside, to some degree, the malting barley prices that we've been talking about in recent weeks, which were the kind of 400 to 396. You know, it's the same magnitude of price differential. Indeed, if barley is coming under pressure, and you could probably argue that barley production may come under a level of pressure. We hope it won't happen in Ireland. But people elsewhere in the world, they tend to move away from barley if they have a choice. So if barley availability comes under pressure, the malting industry knows it has to offer premia there to try and encourage people to plant, manage and produce the kind of quality that that industry needs.
That malt price this week is at 405 there today at the minute.
Okay.
405.
Yeah.
Okay. Just remind us, what was it the first week we got our hands on the price? It was around
400 and it went back to 392 and it came back up last week then again, didn't it, Andy? I can't remember what it exactly was last week, but.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, guys, look, lots happening as always. Okay, so look, we're going to move on. We want to touch on something which we have spoken about before, but I don't think we all agree we haven't really spent enough time on it, because it has colossal implications on tillage farmers this year. And that is, of course, nitrate regulations and the changes that are coming down the line. Siobhan, I think you have a summary of some of the kind of key details that are going to impact tillage farmers. Do you want to give us a flavour?
Yeah, so nitrates, I suppose, look, starting off, slurry has to be incorporated with it. It either has to be spread by low emission slurry spreading equipment or incorporated within 24 hours. And pig slurry will have to be same again, low emission slurry spreading or incorporated, you know, basically straight after. I suppose the main thing that's going to affect people and soon, quite quickly, like, we're on's out on winter barley now. It's looking like July there'll be farmers who will be affected by one of these things that's now in the regulations in nitrates, and that's we're going to have to till the ground basically either 7 days after harvest and chopping, or 7 days after baling, and in total 14 days after harvesting. So that's basically to create a green cover on the ground and try to prevent nitrate leaching. Some of this is still to be decided. So by July, we're meant to have a better idea of what's going to happen, because the proposals, I suppose, if we have all green cover, if we have winter crops and then green cover on the remainder of the cereal area, the tillage area, then we don't have any overwinter stubble. And overwinter stubble is really important for some of our red listed and endangered bird species. So we have until July until we hear about how those rules are going to be affected in order to protect some of those birds. But look, that 7 days post-harvest or baling, it's going to be a hard turnaround. We're hearing a lot about it now.
Change, so it is. That's not 100% confirmed, but it's looking likely. Really, that's going to be the case, isn't it?
That is coming in, but there might be maybe a small area maybe that you're not going to have to till for birds or whatever, but it's going to come in and farmers are going to have to implement it. And I suppose at the walks and things that are going on at the minute, it's being talked about a lot. And I suppose the practicalities of actually implementing this on farm is going to be difficult, aside from some of the other problems that it brings up that I suppose we'll go into.
Andy, is this doable?
Firstly, I would say I think they're going back to the drawing board a little bit on the overall proposal. I think they're looking at things that may end up being a bit more sensible in terms of what the overall benefit and implications will be. We've all seen years when it's not been possible to bale straw until January. And therefore, you know, on the face of it, it's not going to be something that's workable every single year. And it's interesting, you know, the concept behind it is to get more vegetation growing in order to decrease nitrogen loss by using some of the nitrogen that's in the soil for the crops that are going to grow over the ground. I would honestly say that if that's going to be annual meadowgrass in the main, it's actually not going to be very useful or effective one way or the other. It's interesting when you hear farmers talking about it and there's mention of the fact that it is, as a practice, it's actually anti-competitive. And, you know, the more I think about that, the more I realise that it's probably fairly correct, because basically you're forcing a guy to have to find a buyer that will bale and remove grain within a certain period of time. And if he doesn't, he knows he has you by the ghoulies. And that means that, you know, it's obvious price pressure from the word go. That's not something that would be tolerated in any other sector as a measure or a practice. So I think it merits serious consideration in that regard. When I heard of this first, and I'm a person that has always advocated stubble cultivation as a good IPM tool to try and decrease problems into the future. Mm-hmm. But the idea behind this is not just that you actually cultivate, but you are basically prevented from cultivating again. Which is really one of the few tools we may have in the future for a number of fields where we have high levels of resistance to a lot of grass weeds, not just grass weeds, but in particular grass weeds, because we don't have alternatives at the moment for the resistance that's in the grass weeds. So I think that ultimately it is potentially negative. I would much prefer to see other measures being given to people so that people could choose, well, I'm going to do this in this field and I'm going to do that in that field, and all of them contributing to the solution of a problem. You know, if we had the sector, if we had all sectors complying with nitrogen application obligations and restrictions, etc., would we have the problem that we have today? So are we going really, are we just putting in place a system that is easily detectable by satellite so that it can be policed easily, and that the people who may or may not be the biggest cause of the problem are going to be at the butt of it because they can see what we do. I don't know the answer to that, but there's some things about this that sit uneasy with me. I would absolutely want to try and not lose nitrogen from a tillage soil because it costs enough. Even 5 years ago, it cost enough to buy without running the risk of losing it. Nowadays, it is absolutely paramount that we don't lose it, that we try and trap it in any way we can. But we just don't know enough about what is happening, and we don't have good raw science to tell us that tillage fields are the ones that are primarily responsible for the problem.
And like, you know, when we think about this, like, we have 20,000 hectares of cover crops being sown under GLOS. We probably have another 20,000 hectares being sown outside of GLOS. In recent years, the protein area has gone up, so we're not spreading as much nitrogen. There's more malt and barley as well, which maybe isn't getting as much nitrogen or is using nitrogen very efficiently. So tillage has made loads of improvements that maybe haven't been seen in the water quality stats yet. You know, we all hear about that barrow catchment, yeah, but it could take 20 years to see the improvements in the water quality. So, like, I think Andy hit the nail on the head there. Like, it's kind of an easy target where you can do this from a satellite and, you know, say that you're doing something on nitrates, but we're not actually hitting where the real problem is on nitrates.
See, whenever I first heard this, it's just bringing back horrible memories of a real crappy harvest in the northwest at late September, trying to get spring barley or spring oats harvested. Straw still green, can't get it dry, fields are wet, lucky to get the grain out. And it's just not going to work to go on to try and get that baled, to try and get it cleared and try and get it cultivated. And in those situations, it's just not going to work, and farmers aren't going to be able to do it, or else they'll make an absolute mess of their fields. Yeah. And make the problem 10 times worse.
Yeah, and look, if the ground isn't wet enough to cultivate, then cultivation is a negative process for the soil. And the soil is paramount in the production of any crop. And it's as simple as that. I think that we certainly, like, it's a good thing to do. And everybody should aim to do it as quickly as you can post-harvest.
Absolutely.
But the idea of having a fixed time in there, are not knowing at the very beginning how we can introduce a force majeure in the event of this really dirty harvest, Stephen, that you talk about in the northwest, that can hit anybody any year. And arguably, we're getting closer to it as time goes by for the rest of the country in the tillage sector. You know, the thing that worries me always is a bad harvest. We can do everything else right and the harvest weather can completely upset you. So we don't, I'd like to know how that would be dealt with. Because it would be completely wrong to expect people to go out with cultivators onto stubble fields, even if they could clear the straw, when the ground is too wet to cultivate properly. That's a completely negative process in the long term.
Yeah.
I mean, what can farmers do about this? I mean, the decision seems to have already been made without, I don't know if this is the case or not, but it seems like there was very little consultation from a tillage representation point of view. You know, what can tillage farmers do? Where can they make their voice heard, or do we just sit back and accept it?
There was consultations on this, and I suppose, you know, I suppose we can apply to see what went into those consultations and see what the IGGG or the IFA put into those consultations, and this has been passed by Europe, so this, you know, it's probably going to, while it probably can be changed, it's probably going to be quite difficult to change as well. But I suppose people can speak to their local politicians on this and that kind of thing and enforce the message home. Like, you know, we talk about sustainability from all those things, you know, Andy said about weather and tilling when it's wet and things. That's not sustainable for our soils in the long run. But I think another huge thing that has to come into it and which is never thought about is farm safety. And it's putting undue pressure on farmers at their busiest time of year and their most crucial time of year for yield, and it's putting machinery under pressure, it's putting the person under pressure, and, you know, that doesn't seem to come into it at all, and it's something that has to be said.
And that's a bigger issue for those many, many single operator farm businesses that are out there.
Yeah.
You know, you just can't stay going all of the time.
Yeah, and you don't see any kind of pressure like that being asserted on any of the other sectors within that kind of a defined limited time frame, anyway.
Yeah, they have jobs to do. They have other things to do, but they're not either conceivable as anti-competitive, and they are not forcing a lot of extra work to be done in a very narrow window of time. They do probably have more investment to make to do that, but it's not satisfactory, really. There were lots of submissions went in. Personally, I know I was engaged in the process, But there seemed to be an unwillingness to conceive of alternatives. I would be of a view that there are a number of different things that a farmer could do to try and limit or mitigate the risk of loss from his farm or field. The guy that goes in and harvests winter barley, he can probably have a window that he can get in to get straw cleared and get the stubble cultivated. But the next crop that's out, he'll be harvesting the following one before he gets time to get back to cultivate or clear straw. So there should be different things that we can do, a combination of things. I know it adds to administration, but I also know that when you explain to farmers that there are different ways and mechanisms that we can reduce nitrogen loss, farmers will respond themselves without the need for legislation to force it upon them, because these nutrients are costing too much money.
Okay. Guys, look, we're going to move on in the interest of time, but that was well worth having a chat about. And we're probably going to chat about it again before harvest, but every tillage farmer listening should be aware that this is coming. Guys, our last item here on the agenda, I want to get your thoughts on this new scheme which was announced earlier on in the week to pay farmers €1,000 to make hay and silage. So beef and sheep farmers will be paid €100 per hectare for up to 10 hectares of hay and silage this year under a new €55 million fodder scheme. Dairy farmers are excluded from applying. However, the Minister of Agriculture, Charlie McConnell, told the Irish Farmers Journal this week that the scheme was still being finalised, but it will be the latter half of the year before payments are likely to be made to farmers. The scheme will be paid a maximum of €1,000 per farmer. If a farmer had 5 hectares of silage ground and had 2 cuts of it, then they'll qualify for the maximum payment, the minister confirmed. Satellite inspections could be deployed to ensure farmer compliance with the scheme, etc. Read more about that in this week's Farmers Journal. That was an extract from Amy Ford, our acting news editor's front page story. Guys, what's your thoughts? Any sign of a tillage farmer scheme coming? No,
no, still no sign. No? But I suppose remind listeners as well that, you know, if they're making silage, they can apply for this scheme as long as they're not making it for dairy, I suppose. So, you know, if there are people, you know, this is a scheme they can apply for. But on the tillage side of things, still no scheme. And you know, we just talked about nitrates, and we had a tillage incentive measure announced to try and increase the area of tillage. And, you know, it's in a lot of ways essentially a reseeding scheme for livestock farmers. But we talk about increasing the area, but we've just spoke about nitrates and we've convergence coming. And I see a lot of barriers to increase the area tillage. But I still haven't seen any real action to, you know, in all these schemes that are coming out. Well, there are other schemes like Strong Corporation or Protein or whatever. Still no scheme to help with the high diesel and high fertilizer costs this year.
Stephen, as I look at it, I'm always reminded of the old saying that a forecast famine never happens. And will €1,000 make an awful lot of difference to the amount of silage that's made in the country? I don't know that. I guess it'll make some small bit of difference. But it is, in a sense, officially highlighting the fact that there is a problem coming down the track if action isn't taken. And perhaps the scheme would be successful if it does little more than point out to people with stock that there is a need to ensure that we have winter fodder, or to have enough winter fodder for the stock that you're going to have. And I think really what the scheme is doing is it's reinforcing that message to those people, or at least I hope it reinforces the message to the people. The big risk in all of this from the likes of us standing back from it is that the solution that a lot of people have in their head would be to sell stock in the autumn when grass growth slows down. The problem would be that if everybody follows that, then it's a collapse of prices in a farming business that can ill afford to see a collapse in prices. So in a sense, it's doing something, however tangibly little financially, it is doing something to get people to think about the consequences of the direction of travel. Because from everything that we've spoken about here earlier, we're not going to see cheaper feed coming as the solution for people going forward, at least not in the medium term, short or medium term. That seems to be the way it's gearing up to be. So, hopefully, the last thing in the world any of us want to see is something that would give rise to a collapse of prices in any of the livestock sectors that are using feed or grain products.
Okay. All right, guys. To finish up, Andy, what are MedEireann telling us for this week ahead? Are we in for a good spell, settle spell, or more rain?
Well, we're certainly not going to see a completely dry week unless individuals are very, very lucky. But rainfall amounts, not that high, 8, 9, 10 mil for most areas. You're getting a little bit more, Stephen. You have the option of having a drink every single day in the Northwest. But that's hardly going to be a surprise to you.
I see Siobhan laughing across the way this time, so I can, yeah.
Yeah, every other day it was a silent laugh. But, you know, other areas, certainly lots of zeros there, 4 or 5 zeros. So there'll be a lot of work done again in the next week. But wherever you're looking at weather, where you're seeing 1 or 2 mils in the forecast from MedEireann, like, that could be a shower. And based on what they're saying, it is a shower. And you can be lucky and not get the shower, or lucky and get the shower, depending on what your need is. Or you can be unlucky and get rained off doing a job of spraying or something like that. So, you know, those things are important. The west and the southwest certainly seem to be getting the brunt of the rain. So for once, I can say that while you don't have very many dry days, Stephen, the overall amount of rainfall that's forecast for you for the next week is a lot less than it is for the southwest. Looking at wind speeds, generally not problematic up to the middle of next week. Rising a bit then, so spraying could get a little bit difficult. But it's kind of good to see the winds whipping back around to the southwest, away from ones of various easterly origins, because they're naturally more growthy. It's softer conditions. You feel the heat rather than the chill, regardless of the temperature. And those things kind of matter. And we're looking next week at maximum temperatures listed at the moment from 14 to 16 and minimums from 6 to 11. So, you know, that's significantly up on where we had been, say, 2 or 3 weeks ago. And on balance, that's leaving us in a net growth scenario because nighttime temperatures are not that low.
Okay.
So not bad, all things told, I think. And I could say they're compliant with the old saying of the wet and the windy May filling the barn with corn and hay.
Good. Please God. Of all years, we need it this year. So look, there we're going to have to leave it for another week. Andy, Siobhan, thank you very much for joining me here in studio. Great to see us here in person. Thank you all very much for listening at home. And until next week, stay safe, stay tillage farming.
We hope you enjoyed this Irish Farmers Journal podcast. You can find all our podcasts at farmersjournal.ie/podcast and on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.